What up, what up? Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Yes, I'm Michael Steele. Yeah, you know him, you love him. Right, exactly. I'm so glad you guys could be with us for another great conversation. A lot going on since last we spoke. We've had an impeachment trial and a decision there. We've had Donald Trump sort of pop his head up a little bit and spew all kinds of venom on Mitch McConnell. We may get into that. You know, it's so yesterday. Today I wanted to sort of get into a different frame of reference for us, because as I was talking to our guest before we started, there were a lot of Marines on the wall for our democracy, and Rosa Brooks was one of them. And I think she will have a lot of insights for us about what that was like. But there's some other things that Ms. Brooks has done that is actually equally more exciting and interesting. She is a law professor at Georgetown University, my alma mater. Yay! Hoya Saxa.
Hoya Saxa.
Yeah, and founder of Georgetown's Innovative Policing Program. Hint, hint, hint. You know where we're going, right? From 2016 to 2020, she served as a reserve police officer with the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. And as a native Washingtonian who grew up with the D.C. police, I know what her stint was like there. It was on every day interesting, I'm sure. She has worked previously at the Defense Department, the State Department, and for several international human rights organizations. Her new book is called Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City. And here we go.
This is a nice book you've got there.
It's a beautiful book, baby. Yes, indeed. Yes, it is. Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City. Welcome, Rosa, to the podcast.
Michael, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
And buying a book.
Yeah. Hey, right here. And look, we really want people to sort of appreciate not just the book, but I really want to get into the conversation around this book, because you touch on a lot of very important policy, political issues that permeate through this whole policing narrative. And there's a lot of misunderstanding. There's a lot of truth. But before I actually dive into that, I just want to know, how did this sister wind up in the police department? How did you go from being a law professor to a metropolitan police officer?
You know, I have such a bad answer to that question, but you know, there's this famous line attributed to George Mallory, you know, one of the early Everest explorers. They said, "Why are you trying to climb Mount Everest?" And he said, "Because it's there."
Right.
And that's sort of the truth. You know, when I found out that Washington, D.C. had this program where you can apply to be a volunteer police officer, and if you're accepted and you complete the training at the academy, they give you a badge and a gun. I was like, you're kidding me. Really? You're going to give a badge and a gun to a law professor? Like, that's dumb.
Not the best day at the office with that decision.
Although, you know, I did often think it could come in handy at the occasional faculty meeting. But no, I was just curious. It was just so fascinating. And as you know, Michael, the world of policing is so closed and opaque often to people on the outside of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of that blue wall of silence or thin blue line or whatever you want to call it. And it's really hard to understand, you know, police culture. And it just seemed like such an incredible opportunity to be on the inside and try to understand what it's like, and what are the stories that police officers tell themselves about what they do and why they do it. And you know, the other piece of it, this is related to because it was there, is I'm actually really nosy. Mm-hmm. I'm always kind of fascinated by other people's stories and other world. You know, whenever I meet an architect, I'm like, wow, that's cool. What is it like to be an architect? You know, or whatever it may be. I always want to know more. And usually people don't let you, you know, be a, you know, one day a week volunteer in their world. So I'm just nosy.
You just know. So, well, on your way to being nosy, what I chuckled at once you'd finally decided to go ahead and do this thing, because as you said, you mean you'll actually let me do this? You talk about, despite my determination not to complain, I resented the PT test.
Oh, yeah. Because, okay. So I'm not a duck.
You start with the 1.5 mile run, and then it goes downhill
from there. I am not a duck. I kind of like to sit on the sofa, drinking a cup of tea with my feet up and a nice mystery. I like reading about cops and detectives and a few murders from my sofa. But when they were like, and you got to do push-ups and you got to do sit-ups and you got to do a sprint and you got to do a 1.5 mile run, I was like, what? So that was pretty.
Don't give me the badge and the gun. You mean
I know. The nerve.
I have to train to be a cop. So what did you find? What did you discover in this very, it's a very personal journey. And there's some really, you go into some really funny stories, which I'd like you to touch on, like you said, you wake up one day after law class and you go, I think I'm just going to join the police force. There's going to be some humor there that comes with that. But what did you discover about policing and how citizens look at it and how the various institutions that not only govern it, but rely on it, look at it?
Oh man, that's kind of it's a big question. And so I had the world's crappiest elevator speech about my book. People would be like, oh, no kidding. You became a reserve police officer and you're writing a book about it. That's so fascinating. What's your argument? Give me the one sentence elevator pitch. And I was like, it's really complicated. And they were like, that's the crappiest elevator speech I've ever. But it, it's true too. That is the lesson that I learned. I think we live in a political culture where, as you know, everything is simplistic slogans and stereotypes and sound bites, and depending on who you are and what your politics are, when policing comes up, it's either the police are heroes, they sacrifice themselves, are underappreciated, I'm not going to hear a word against them, or it's they're brutal racist thugs and I'm not going to hear a word in their favor.
Right.
And I think, I get suspicious whenever people's views kind of are, on these really extreme ends of the spectrum. I always start thinking, I bet it's kind of more complicated than that. And that was the lesson, that it is absolutely more complicated, that there's heroism, there's self-sacrifice, there is brutality, there is racism, there is cynicism, and they're all kind of tangled up together.
How do we untangle it? I mean, which ward were you policing?
So I was in the 7th district. They don't quite correspond to the wards. They sort of do, but not.
Yeah, that's right, because they do kind of overlap.
I don't know why they do that, right? But it's the southern part of Anacostia.
You were in the neighborhood.
Yeah. You know where the big chair is?
Yes, indeed. I love that chair. I grew up with
pretty
that
much on south from that chair.
Yes. Just so folks know, in this neighborhood in Anacostia, there was a furniture store that was originally there. I don't know if this furniture store is still there.
Explain the big chair.
Yes.
It was originally
a furniture store. And that's how they got you to come in. They had this big ass chair that they had put out. Folks, when I say a big ass chair, I'm talking about a chair that's at least two stories.
Yeah,
it's the size of a townhouse, of a row house. It's a landmark. It is a huge part of that community.
It's a very large chair. You'd have to be a really big person to sit in this chair.
Very big.
And I'm so glad you told me that, because I was always saying to people, like, what's the story with the chair? Is it like a sculpture? Is it like for a giant, like a race of giants who no longer inhabit the earth, or what? And everybody's like, I don't know, it's just a chair. But now I know. Okay.
That chair's been there for over 50 years.
That is very, very good to know. So it's the part of DC that is probably poorest.
Yeah.
And it's the part of DC that in a typical year has the highest rates of violent crime and homicides.
So you were in the hood. So that is important for our discussion. So people can be disabused of, oh no, well, she was working in the white enclaves of Ward 3 or Ward 2, which is west, the western part of the city in Georgetown and places like that, or even where you have the upper Black middle class of the formerly known Gold Coast, which is the 16th Street corridor, Ward 4, where I grew up, on the other side of 16th Street. So you were in the part of the city that has real confrontations around policing and issues related to that. What did you learn from that experience that opened your eyes in a way that your eyes just weren't open to before? Not that they were shut and it just wasn't in your experience as a law professor, especially. But what opened your eyes about that time?
You know, I think two things that almost seem like they're contradictory, but this is what I mean when I say it's complicated. There are two things that are a little contradictory, but both really true. One is, you know, people often complain that especially in poor communities, communities of color, that the police are like an occupying force and they're overpoliced, right, and people get arrested for trivial stuff and it makes their lives worse. So that's true. You know, the vast majority of the arrests that my partners and I made were of very poor people who had offended in pretty trivial ways and for whom arrests were not going to make anybody's life better. They weren't going to make the victim's life better. They weren't going to make the perpetrator's life better. They weren't going to make the community's life better. And I felt pretty crappy about a lot of the arrests that we made, that it just sort of felt like, man, here you're taking people who are really struggling. And sometimes we're kind of messed up, you know, by definition, a lot of the people who end up encountering the police are, you know, they don't tend to be people who have their act together. They tend to be people who either are having some big problem because they're victims or they're perpetrators because they're kind of messed up. You know, maybe there's mental illness, maybe there's drug addiction, maybe it's something else. But, you know, they end up encountering the police and they end up getting kind of swept up in the criminal justice system because we have, as a society, criminalized an incredible variety of really trivial forms of misbehavior. And it's just terrible because you're kind of scooping people up and then they get spat back out again and public money has been wasted and they have a criminal record or more of a criminal record and nobody's better off. So that's true. You know, I think that is very powerfully true. At the same time, I also saw firsthand that the cops don't show up because they want to be an occupying force. They show up because people call 911. You know, they show up because people ask for them. And, you know, we weren't going around looking for people to arrest. We were responding to 911 calls. And people often call 911 for reasons where they shouldn't be calling the police, but they call the police because they don't know who else to call. Right. You know, they call the police because there's a group of, you know, boys on the corner who are kind of harassing people who walk by or scaring them. They call the police because their neighbor's having a loud party. They call the police because they see somebody selling drugs in the neighborhood. You know, they call the police because they're having a fight with their sister or because they want somebody to scare their teenage son into behaving better and listening to them. You know, and a lot of the, you know, they also call the police because they've been robbed at gunpoint or burglarized or whatever. But people call the police for all kinds of stuff, including trivial stuff. And they want those police services. And maybe they shouldn't, you know, maybe they should solve their problems in another way. Or maybe there should be some, you know, better mystical non-existent city agency that kind of comes and solves their problems for you, but are not the police. But in the absence of that, you know, mystical agency that solves your problems for you, they call the police. And so you see a heavy police presence in part because there's a real demand for policing. And in fact, that actually, I encountered very little hostility from people every now and then. Right. You know, you get somebody would spit or call you a nasty name as you walked by. But by and large, the thing that was actually pretty amazing to me was the number of people who would say, thank you, officer. You know, we appreciate your coming. We appreciate your work. Right. Sometimes even the people you arrested would say that, which I thought was kind of nice of them.
Yeah,
you know?
we polite, if nothing else, when you arrest us, right?
You know, I mean,
the DC thing.
Right. And I was always like, you're being awfully nice to me. I'm arresting you. You don't have to be so nice to me.
It's either that or you die. I mean, is this how it works?
But I think that is the contradiction. You see right. that playing out in cities all over the country right now, where, you know, people are debating the sort of defund the police and abolish the police. And, you know, the resolution to the contradiction, I think, you know, yes, the police are an occupying force in poor Black communities. Yes, people demand the police and they want police services. And the resolution to the contradiction is that people want good policing. They want better policing. They don't want bad policing. You know, they don't want police who feel hostile or who feel like they're creating a threat more than they're resolving a threat. But they do want people to be responsive if they're scared, if they're in trouble, if they're sick. You know, they want to be able to pick up the phone and call right. and have them show up. And everybody has a right to that. You know, they're entitled to that.
Yeah. And you touch on something that has been an important discussion in the policing arena for certainly the last year. But even before that, you know, I dealt with some of these issues when I was Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, and certainly looking at our criminal justice system, spending 24 hours a day pretty much with our state troopers, because I had a state trooper detail that was with me pretty much all the time. So you really kind of got to see how the police and policing, really, there are moments where they do diverge. You know, the police have this sort of noble view of their service, and they're thinking about, and you just touched on it, when you need me, I will be there for you, right? Yeah. But then policing gets into a bigger, broader issue that has nothing to do with the actual police, or as we're beginning to realize, it shouldn't. And the reason I ping that, because you already alluded to it when you talked about the stuff that is not police related. I love this section in the book when you're talking about your academy, you know, you're speaking about your academy classmate Lowry, and you were talking about you were patrolling with Lowry in 5D when the car's mobile data terminal pinged. We were directed to, quote, check the welfare, end quote, of a man in Northeast DC. Typically, welfare check requests come from concerned neighbors or relatives, right? The mail's piling up, et cetera, et cetera. This particular request came through a more circuitous route. And so you sort of detail what that is. And then Lowry goes, oh, wow, looking at the address, Lowry said, looking at the address, quote, I think this is the, quote, sexually assaulted by monkeys guy. You're in for a treat. What was that all about?
Well,
and I do have a serious question on the back end of your answer.
Well, a few weeks earlier, and Lowry is, I will say, is not his real name.
Right, obviously.
Details change to protect the innocent and guilty alike here. He's a terrific officer. He's a good friend. And he had texted me a screenshot of his patrol car's mobile data terminal, the in-car computer. And it said, you know, complainant says sexually assaulted by monkeys. And he was like, you cannot believe the call I'm on right now. And I was like, oh man. And I was like, how'd that go? And he said, well, we got there and there were no monkeys. And I said, well, sir, you know, I don't see any monkeys. And the guy got really mad at them and said, well, of course they're not here. You scared them away. As soon as they heard you coming, they left. And
hello, logic.
But anyway, so we get there the few weeks later, I'm riding with him. And that was one of the cool things about being reserve officers. You could go to other districts and if you wanted to, you had a lot more freedom than full-time folks. And so we go to this check on the welfare call, and the name of the complainant was in our terminal as Mr. Dracula. And his request was down as he wanted the police to tap his phone. And he had communicated this to the San Francisco police, who thought, Mr. Dracula sounds like he could use somebody checking on his welfare. So we show up and you know, Mr. Dracula had a lot to say to us. Mm-hmm. And most of it didn't make a lot of sense. And it had to do with everything from wiretaps to, you know, the city listening in through his light bulbs to Mickey Mouse and very abusive things involving toys to aliens.
Right.
And eventually he told us to get lost. And we kind of sheepishly said, well, goodbye, Mr. Dracula. And we went away.
But see that. And the reason I wanted to ping that story, and it dovetailed perfectly into what you were just saying. How have you come down as someone who clearly now has not only taught about the law and law enforcement mm-hmm. and the Constitution and how all these things are interrelated, you know, our individual rights, our liberties, and all that, but then experienced it on the ground, talking with the guy who's been, you know, accosted by monkeys, or dealing with the citizen who spits at you because they have an idea of who you are.
Right.
How do you come down on this idea that, going back to the point I was making about police versus policing, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that we be more critical in our thinking about what we assign our police to do.
Yeah.
And that, I'm sorry, a police officer may not be the appropriate person to go see Mr. Dracula.
Yes.
A police officer may not be the most appropriate person to go settle or try to calm a domestic dispute. In fact, I know here in our state, and I'm sure the same is true in my old home of DC, that's one of the most dangerous moments for a police officer when they're on a domestic call.
Yeah,
because the person you've been sent in to help can actually wind up turning on you in that split moment, because you're now arresting her husband or arresting his wife. How do you see that playing out going forward? What should we be looking at and really taking seriously when we're assessing police work? Because I'm not down with defunding police. It's one of the dumbest things that ever come out of the mouths of anyone who ever uttered the words. But there is a lot of value to let's reimagine what our police do.
Yeah, and I actually think the language, the rhetoric there, defund the police, gets people off on the wrong track.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you say that to a 7D officer and they're like, excuse me, have you seen our station? You think we've got too much money? Have you seen my car? Have you seen my equipment?
Right.
And, you know, they get huffy and defensive. They're like, are you kidding me? I'm trying to do the things that you, the citizens, have told me to do with inadequate resources. Yeah. But if you ask a really different question, if you say to a cop, what are the things that you do that you wish you didn't have to do because you don't think cops are the right people to do it? You know, what other services do you wish existed? What other people, what other options do you wish existed? Then I think you have a really different conversation. And that's where I think you start finding actually a lot of common ground between critics of policing and police themselves. And I think your distinction between the police and policing is a really important one. You know, by the time a cop gets involved, typically all the choices are bad ones, you know,
because good point.
The system itself is so messed up in so many ways. And that means that even good cops often end up doing things that create bad results for people because they're inside a system that doesn't give them many options, that doesn't have alternatives to policing. But I think, you know, I think they're kind of two separate issues. In the middle of what you were saying, you know, one is an issue of who should respond to certain types of problems and calls. And the other is an issue of what kinds of responses should there be? Should they be what happens after the fact, right? So maybe we do want police to go to domestic violence calls because, as you said, they can be dangerous. They're one of the most fraught situations. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't want to send your social worker to that, right?
Right.
Or you don't want to send your social worker alone to that.
Well, I was going to say, maybe it's a combination.
Right.
We start with, I mean, it's like a hostage negotiation. You don't send the guys the snipers who could take the guy or the gal out. You send in the hostage negotiator to kind of, you know, see if you can
resolve it. And we have a pilot program in DC that does exactly that, that sends a combination of paid folks and trained volunteers who ride along with police and who go after the police have made sure the scene is safe, go in and can provide information about resources for domestic violence victims, et cetera. And that kind of approach, I think, actually has a lot of promise, although the folks should be paid. They shouldn't all be volunteers because you can't get that far that way. But DC, for instance, has a mandatory arrest rule for domestic violence offenses. And that's one of those well-meaning pieces of legislation that was responding to a real problem. And the real problem historically was that, you know, man beats up woman, cops come, they dismiss it as not a big deal, private problem, work it out, and they walk away, leaving, you know, the woman to be beaten again and again and again. And that's why the city developed, you know, a mandatory arrest rule. The problem with that is that over the years, the city also expanded what counts as domestic relationship. So it wasn't just, you know, spouses or intimate partners. It became siblings, adult siblings, right. Housemates, roommates, former housemates and roommates. And so what that meant is that now you got, and I talk about one of these examples in my book, you know, mm-hmm. two adult sisters who get into a scuffle over whose turn it is to use the washing machine. And one of them ends up, you know, going to jail. Right. Which is crazy, you know, so there's sort of a separate question. Maybe you need police to respond because you don't go knowing what the situation is, but is arresting somebody a useful response? No, it's a stupid response. You know, what these people needed was something very, very different than somebody being arresting, and that didn't help anybody. It just hurt everybody involved. And, you know, I think even separate from that, I think you're 100% right, 200% right. Is that a percent you can have? Probably not. Math this way, right. Right? We don't do math.
You're a law professor. I don't expect you to do math.
700%, right. You know, the right question to be asking is, I've always say this, you know, my other world is national security. I say this about the defense budget too. We shouldn't be saying, is the defense budget too big? Is the defense budget too small? We should be saying, well, what exactly do you want the military to do?
Right, right.
And what resources do they need? What structures do they need? What kind of people do they need to do it effectively?
Right.
And the same is true for policing. You know, what do we want police to do? And here's one that is sort of so obvious, and yet most of us don't tend to think about it. We've decided as a society that we want armed, uniformed people to stop your car if you turn right on red when there's a sign that says no right on red. And so we don't decide that we're going to have armed uniform guys show up at your house if you miss an IRS estimated tax filing deadline, right?
Right.
We don't decide that there's going to be a cop showing up at your door if your hedges are overgrown and violate the neighborhood residential zoning code. You're just going to get a letter in the mail, right?
Right.
And when we're so used to just, of course, police have to stop people. These aren't criminal acts. These are civil infractions. Like, cops have to stop somebody who's shooting out the window as they drive, you know, or a drunk driver.
Right.
But really, we need police to stop you because you've got a pair of dice hanging from your, you know, rearview mirror, something like that. So we've created the situation where we decided that we're going to have cops do this. It's terrifying for motorists. You know, I've never yet met a motorist, including off-duty cops, who isn't like, yeah, my heart starts thumping. I freak, you know, I go, when those lights come on,
that just changes your world.
It's scary. It's incredibly scary. It's another really fraught and dangerous situation for the cops and the people in the car alike. You know, it's a scary situation for everybody. It uses up police time. We could decide that we're going to have more cameras at intersections instead, and people get more tickets in the mail. We could decide that we're going to have unarmed traffic enforcement civilians who pull up alongside you and give you a ticket. Or we could decide that we don't actually really care that much.
See, Rose, that's, you're so good at this, at peeling back this curtain, because I have been, and I discovered this a little bit when I was in office. And particularly, again, talking to the police officers, our state troopers. So we have corridors in the state. As you know, we have sections in D.C., whether it's New York Avenue or, you know, Rhode Island or whatever, where the cops, you know, are going to be, and they, you know, pull you over. And the cops don't want to do it. I mean, they hate traffic stops because a lot of what you just said, they're fraught with danger to begin with.
You got to fill out a lot of really boring forms.
You got to fill out a lot. That's why they always say to you, well, I've already started filling out the form, baby. You getting this ticket. Because they know you just can't undo the ink, right?
True, some of the time.
Yeah. So why not be imaginative and create a civilian traffic force that have all of the stopping authority and power that we give our police, but they're not police. Free our police up to do the very critical and important civil service around policing, safeguarding, protecting, serving the neighborhoods and communities. very much as we decided, well, we don't want cops handing out parking tickets anymore, walking the streets and handing out parking. We created, you know, meter people. And that's what they do. They, you know, they now walk around, and we all know them in D.C. because Lord knows we've all met them at some point.
Oh, no, please. No, no. I was just leaving.
Nope. You're getting this one. So that's the kind of reimagining I think can go a long way to alleviating a lot of the pressures that we've seen boil over in communities. Yeah. One other point before we take a break, and because I do want to talk about some of the other work you've done on the legal side of your career, especially in the space of voting and protecting our democracy. So you protect our democracy on the ground and in neighborhoods as a former police officer.
I don't know if I go that far.
Well, no, you'd be surprised.
I always feel that way.
You'd be surprised. I think of police in that regard. It's a very tough job.
And maybe we'll talk after the break about the events of January 6th.
Yes.
I had left the MPD, the Metropolitan Police Department, by then, but I had friends and colleagues who were literally fighting to protect democracy on January 6th. And, yep. You know, so it does happen.
And so the question is, in the context of what we were just describing about this reimagination of our police force and the kind of policing and work that they do, how will those things lend themselves toward eliminating a lot of the tensions that exist in the Black community, for example? You know, I not only had then when they were young boys, just learning how to drive, et cetera, but even today as young men, my two sons who are in their late 20s and early 30s, have that 10 and 2 conversation about their encounters with the men and women in blue. What as a parent, as a Black parent, you patrolled a Black neighborhood. So you had those conversations, I'm sure. What do you see helping us move past some of those difficult discussions?
What it really is why do we have armed people enforcing stupid stuff that they don't need to enforce? You know, the more enforcement contacts cops have with people, the more likely there is to have something go wrong. And somebody get hurt. And even if nobody gets hurt, those experiences, whether it's a traffic stop or a pedestrian stop, you know, they can be frightening, they can be humiliating. Absolute best case, they're inconvenient. Worst case, they're inconvenient and they're terrifying and humiliating at the same time. Really worst case, they get dangerous. And, you know, I think it's a similar issue when you think about pedestrian stops. And it's a hard one, right? Because here in DC, for instance, as in many cities, we've seen a real spike in gun violence and gun homicides, and there's been tremendous political pressure coming from the mayor and the city council for the police to get guns off the street, which of course has translated into the police stopping more people. And, you know, the really egregious place, of course, where this happened was New York City, where there, you know, a really aggressive stop and frisk program.
Right.
And what was happening is that, you know, the hit rate, the percentage of those stops that actually turned up weapons was really quite low. There's also racial disparities, which is a whole other problem. But even without the issue of the racial disparities, you know, you're stopping several hundred people, you're getting a tiny handful of guns. Well, it's good to get the guns off the street. On the other hand, you know, let's say hypothetically, you stop 99 people, you get one gun. Well, you've got one gun and you've got 99 alienated, upset, humiliated, terrified people. And you actually have to ask yourself a question, just a cost-benefit analysis of overall, is this going to make this community safer, better, happier? Is this going to make people trust the police and give us information about who's got the illegal guns, what they're up to, and so on? You know, and we don't have those conversations, but the more you have cops doing that kind of routine enforcement contact with people, the more you risk having situations that get dangerous or are just scary and humiliating for people. That has real costs too. Having guns on the streets has real costs, you know, but so does frightening people, pissing people off, especially when there are racial disparities. And, you know, what they found in New York was, I don't have the stats at my fingertips, but essentially a higher percentage of white people stopped than Black people stopped actually had weapons, which basically tells you that the police were overestimating the percentage of Black people likely to have weapons and underestimating the percentage of white people likely to have weapons, which means a much higher percentage of totally innocent African Americans just minding their own business get this scary, humiliating stop than white people. When you add racial disparities to the whole thing, you really create a combustible mix where people are really angry, and rightly so. Right. They're like, I'm just minding my own business and cops are always harassing me.
Right.
And again, you know, it is sort of, it's a cost benefit analysis on some level. What's going to be better for the community, and who should decide what's better for the community? Is it getting X number of guns off the street at the cost of, you know, X times 10 number of really upset community mm-hmm. members? How do you evaluate that? And I don't think police typically are very good at thinking those things through, because the default for cops is guns, okay, stop more people, you know, rather than to say, well, let's have a really different kind of conversation about what's driving the increase in guns, what's driving the increase in homicides. Maybe this is something where the best strategy is not to be stopping more people, but the best strategy is to be trying to develop better relationships in the community so people tell us who the guys are who are getting right. the guns. Right.
And that's what it was for me when I growing up in Washington. There was a rec center probably about three blocks down 8th Street from where I lived. And there was always at that time, you know, a police officer or two who was hanging out there. What helped a lot in my neighborhood growing up was the cops grew up with us. In other words, they watched me grow up. Right. They watched the other guys, and they knew who the bad boys were, and mm-hmm. they knew who the good boys were. Yeah. They knew the parents in many cases. So that level of community policing, I think, is an essential part of what you're talking about in terms of how police should be deployed and engaged, because it helps alleviate a lot of that pressure and this idea of, yeah, we got to get the guns off the street. Well, guess what? Guess who will be involved in helping them do that?
Right. That's right.
The citizens who live in that community, because now they've got a different relationship with the police.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think everybody knows that on some level, intellectually in their heads, they know that, but almost everything about the way policing is structured in terms of the shifts, in terms of, you know, how we assign officers to calls, mean that officers very rarely have the time or the incentive to do that kind of slow relationship building. You're never going to get in trouble for doing traffic stops and issuing tickets or making lawful arrests. Right. But if all you have to say to your sergeant at the end of the shift is, yeah, I didn't go to those calls because I thought they were crap, but I hung out at the rec center all day and I had some really great conversations with a bunch of kids. And I, you know, that's harder to justify.
Right.
So, you know, you'd have to really rethink the way you evaluate officers, the way you allocate their time, if you wanted to have an approach that was focused more on that kind of long-term relationship building.
She's Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks.
It is an honor. You have no idea how many times people said this to me, like, I thought you'd be an elderly African American.
Rosa Parks just popped in my head. Oh my God, that would be one hell of a conversation. Rosa Brooks. We're having a conversation with Rosa Brooks. We're going to take a break, folks. When we come back, more with Rosa right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, everybody. So welcome back. And as we start to wind down our conversation, I did not want to leave off the table some of the work that you've done, Rosa, that I've had the privilege of working with you and serving as a colleague on, in particular, the National Task Force on Election Crisis, where our goal there was to identify actions that, you know, that could be taken before the general election to sort of figure out how we navigate in that space to prevent and mitigate against the crazy that we thought could come. And you, in a particular way, had a role in pulling together, along with Niles Gilman, the Transition Integrity Project. These, again, an effort that would work to navigate the post-election environment and what that space would look like and what we as citizens need to be aware of to push back against the lies and the deceit and the misinformation around mail-in ballots and all of that. We saw, because of how this election was set up and framed by the Trump administration and some members of my party on Capitol Hill, some would argue, myself being one of them, that lit the flame and the torch and the fire and all that stuff for January 6th. Given the work that you did to try to prevent a lot of stuff from happening, then seeing something like January 6th happen, what's your assessment of our struggles right now on the democracy front with voting rights, with the appropriate respect for democratic principles, constitutional norms, et cetera?
We're in deep shit. Your party, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on where your party ought to be going here. It seems to me as a Democrat that when the only way to win is to suppress voting, you should rethink your approach. <You're right. laughs> You know, I mean, maybe you need a different platform. Right?
Yeah, the strategy may be a little bit off.
Yeah. The two things that are most distressing to me, one is that we clearly have a pretty significant chunk of our population that really doesn't care about democracy, you know, that really is not interested, that wants a strong man, you know, that is scared of change, is scared of people who look different, and, you know, just feels like, hey, whatever it takes to protect me and what I believe my way of life to be, whatever that may mean to me, just do it. And I don't care if it's democratic or not. I don't care if you have to lie, cheat, and steal. The ends justify the means. And that's mm-hmm. pretty scary. The other really scary thing is that we have a very large percentage of Republican elected officials who seem equally willing to take that approach. And that is just shocking to me in a way. I really am kind of stunned by that. The sort of short-sighted political expedience that clearly is motivating so right. many in Congress, just this fear of, there's always this question of, well, you know, sure, they're scared they won't get reelected if they openly criticize Donald Trump, for instance. But I've always believed that leadership matters, and that, you know, when leaders go back to their constituents and say, okay, I did this thing that you don't like, let me tell you why, and are straight with them and act like leaders, that people will follow. You know, that it's not just sort of your constituents want this, that's the end of the story. You know, you've got a duty, and you are an elected official. You got a mm-hmm. duty to, you know, yes, you have to represent your constituents, but you also have a duty to tell them the truth.
Right.
And not pander to a bunch of lies and misinformation. So I am very worried. I do not think we're out of the woods. I think we, you know, to use a different metaphor, we dodged a bullet. Mm-hmm. But there are other bullets, or we're still in the woods full of bullets.
Yeah, how do you see that?
My metaphors.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair.
We're full of bullets.
Yeah, full of bullets. But no, I think it's a fair analysis of where this is. I was sitting here looking at the cover of your book, and again, folks, the book that Rosa's got out now is Tangled Up in Blue: Policing the American City. In this part of our discussion, you could almost rename and retitle this book, Tangled Up, just how we're all now tangled up in this, this new kind of environment where so many of our citizens have become anti-democratic and have bought the strong man narrative. And what that may mean for a country that was founded 180 degrees away from that. We were founded with the idea of getting away from the strong man. We did not like King George III because of the tyrant that he was. And you know, George Washington refused to accept the mantle of, you know, king or president for life because he knew that was not what the founding idea was. Is this a question of victimhood? People feel so put upon and such the victim. Oh, you know, they, you know, my son can't get a job, or, you know, they're going to take away my guns and I'm helpless and hapless. I've heard people say that, but they don't say it in a way that, you know, I want to disparage. I really want to say, really, how is it? Why is it that bad? What can you tell me? So clearly there's something going on there with a lot of people that they feel that the country's turned on them. And Trump became the avatar for pushing back against that.
Yeah, no, it's a little bit of a puzzle, right? Because some of this is deliberate misinformation campaigns and sort of, you know, I don't think it's overstating it to call it information warfare. Mm-hmm. You know, that a lot of people have been kind of sold a bill of goods, right? And they have come to believe falsely, you know, that the liberals are going to come and take your guns away from you, and they're going to make your children change their gender, you know.
Right. That was one of my favorites. Yeah.
You know, they're not going to let you be called whatever you want to be called. And there's this kind of,
that's the cancel culture and all of that.
Yeah. And the cancel culture is real, and it's a problem, and it's stupid, and it's overblown, and all that kind of stuff. But it's a trivial problem. It's a really trivial problem in a really tiny group of people, you know, and most people are not part of this culture, and most people don't care at all.
Right.
But the sense, the exaggerated sense of threat, you know, they're going to turn my children into gays, lesbians, and transgendered people, and they're going to take away my guns, and, you know, who knows what they're going to do. I do think it's sort of two things combining in a really dangerous way. One is kind of deliberate information warfare manipulation. And I don't even think it's any, I'm not even interested anymore in, like, was it the Russians? Was it, you know, the indigenous American extremists? Was it Steve Bannon? It doesn't matter, right? Because whatever it was at the start, it's now indigenous, right?
Right.
Maybe it was 100% the Russians at the beginning, but now it's us. You know, people, the percentage of people who are in their tiny little bubble where all they hear reinforces these extremist views, and they've been told over and over again that the mainstream media is lying to them, you know, and you can't penetrate that bubble, and that's really scary. And it intersects with the other thing, you know, the sort of two phenomena that intersect. I do think it has more to do with a kind of sense of tribal identity.
Right.
And it has to do with economics or specific policies. Because when you do these polls, policy by policy, Americans are actually mostly not that extremist. You know,
no, they're not.
They're pretty moderate.
Yeah.
But then they kind of go bonkers when you say something like Democrats or Biden or Hillary Clinton, God knows, my God.
You said the H word. Oh, Lord, here we go.
You know, she's got horns, and she's got a child sex ring and a pizza place. And you're just like, what? You know, like, I'm sure.
I mean, she couldn't pick like a nice little, you know, a restaurant with, you know, some.
Oh,
know,
my God.
A pizza place. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, right. There are a lot of things in this world I am not sure about, but I am 100% sure that Hillary Clinton is not and never has operated child sex trafficking ring inside of a pizza place. Right. But you know what I mean? I do think it is more than it's, you know, it's what people call kind of identity threat. It's not really about money. It's not really about taxes, not really about policies. You know, that there is just this sense, it is a sense of fear, and it's not entirely white Americans, but it's mostly white Americans.
Right.
And it's this sense of the world is changing. I used to know the rules. Now I don't know the rules. Now are all these weirdos who look different and who have funny accents, you know, or they have dark skin, or they're telling me that, you know, their personal pronoun is they, and that doesn't make any sense to me. And I feel threatened and I feel scared.
Right. Right. And for me, the key is the first thing that you said, I used to know the rules.
Right.
And you used to know the rules because you were reliant on folks who look like you to write them.
Yeah.
And that more than anything else is the part that is the most disturbing, because now you as a woman, me as an African-American, we get to write the rules too.
Right.
And that is a very different dynamic for a country and culture that literally formed itself around a different persona. And while they may have written the beautiful flowering words about equality for all, now we really ain't mean that shit. That wasn't applicable to everybody, you know? And so now everybody's like, no, it is applicable to all of us. Because we
wait a minute here.
Right?
You mean you?
They didn't really mean you. Exactly. It's just me. And I think that's a big driver for a lot of people, the fear of the rules changing by the hand of those who once were not allowed to make such changes or involved in those changes. And what I try to say to folks is, it's okay. Look, we've been on the side of repression and aggression and Jim Crow and slavery and can't vote and don't have any power and making 70 cents on the dollar. And we've been there. So we're not going to do that to you. Because we know in the long run, it doesn't help anybody, and it doesn't help the country.
It's such a tragedy, you know, because I think it's not an accident that when you look at people who hold the most fearful and biased attitudes towards people who don't look like them, don't talk like them, they tend to be people who've never met anybody who's actually different.
Right.
People who live in very diverse areas tend to have much less anxiety about diversity.
Right.
And the thing is, it's like, you know, I was born in New York City. I live in the Washington, D.C. area. I think that it is the coolest thing about being an American that I get to meet all these people who aren't like me.
Right.
And yeah, it can be intimidating. You walk into, you know, and I've traveled a lot in other countries, as I know you have too.
Yeah.
And you go to a place and you're like, whoa, these people look different. They talk different. They eat weird foods. And this is a little scary. And then you get to know them. You're like, wow, that was really cool. And now I know more stuff than I knew. And I've met these amazing people and I never would have known
I actually like that dish.
And that was pretty good, you know. This is America's greatest strength. This is the gift that we have in this country, is that we have people that come here from all over the world. They have every ethnic and racial ancestry and every linguistic tradition, every cultural tradition under the sun. And they come here because they care about this country, and they stay here because they care about this country. And just the tragedy of people who look at that and get scared and angry, as opposed to looking at that and seeing it as the gift that it is. You know, the gift for all of us to get smarter, to get better, to meet new people, to learn new things. You know, that's what fuels innovation. You know, it's people kind of rub up against each other a little bit and you go, you know, hey, wait, you can't put your chocolate in my peanut butter. And you're like, oh, wait, that was pretty good.
Actually,
Reese's peanut butter cup. Awesome. You know, like, you don't get that if you're always in the, oh, I do chocolate. No, I don't do peanut, you know, or whatever.
Right.
You gotta push yourself a little bit out of your comfort zone. You know, that's how we get smarter and better.
And that's always been the strength of this country, to force us outside of our comfort zone. And that's what Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City, gets into. It's getting us a little bit outside of our comfort zone and understanding what policing and the police and what the experiences are in an American city today for a lot of citizens. Rosa Brooks, appreciate you stopping by and breaking a word or two with us. It's always a pleasure. I've enjoyed our association and working together. We've had the chance to appear on air together from time to time, and it's always just a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Michael, and for all the work that you've done.
Oh, look, I'm just a brother in the neighborhood. just hanging out. But I appreciate that very much.
Kind of a nice neighborhood. Where you got like the Acropolis behind you?
Yeah, well, this is my Lincoln Memorial tribute here. That's the
Lincoln Memorial. Awesome.
Lincoln Memorial. Yeah. So, but now I appreciate you very, very much. And folks, that does it for this episode. This conversation. I appreciate you taking time to hang out with us. Don't forget to do that download thing. You know what? Love it when you download. It makes me feel all yummy inside when you do the download thing. You can find me on podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify. I'm there. I'm the guy with the smile. And check us out. But until next time, stay safe, stay well, wear the damn mask. Later.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.